The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
You guys are quiet. It's making me quiet. So, when we come to practice, we're even familiar with what's called in Buddhist commentaries like the two wings of awakening, of wisdom and compassion, or sometimes Thich Nhat Hanh uses the language of understanding and love. And usually when people come to practice, they have a kind of affinity for one more than the other. More drawn to maybe clarity, calm, seeing, penetrating insight, that side, or more drawn to love, the heart, kindness. So just as a little poll, you don't have to vote. More drawn to the wisdom side. Heart. Okay. Pretty well balanced here. Now, the suggestion is that We need balance. And so on the one hand, it's good to, in general, it's good to follow where the interest is and where the mind goes. And on the other hand, it's critical to like double back and to integrate the other side of practice. Now, I think ultimately these two sides, they do converge. They do converge. That is, that wisdom in its wake brings love. And love makes the ground very fertile for us to realize wisdom more deeply. I was talking to a senior teacher, somebody who has, you know, been in the scene for since the 60s, knows all the folks who have had major influence on the Insight movement in the U.S. And I was struck by something he said, which was that in seeing the senior, pioneering teachers over the decades, what he felt like made the most he saw a lot of continuity in their personality and style over the decades. And what he said was that that more than anything, he saw metta making the biggest difference. in people's lives, how he experienced them as human beings. Felt like actually, and I'm not making a pitch for the heart side over the wisdom side, but that this was really had some very enduring effects on their lives, and of course as an effect of that, how a lot of how we practice. So I wanted to talk a bit about metta, loving kindness, and it's a state that increasingly can become the kind of default position of our minds. That is, normally we all have our kind of default positions, right? The mind, where the mind like just naturally seems to gravitate to, where the path of least resistance is. I my feeling is that of the different like ways that practice can change, one of them is where the mind goes, where that default position is, changes over time. That is where the mind defaults to when we're not trying to control the mind. That it increasingly can default to something like this very simple, soft kindness. An image of metta is a mother cow gazing at her calf. And I like that image because it's kind of, there's a softness to it. And often when we actually do the metta practice, do this practice of connecting with loving friendliness, there's a sense that it should be like the metta geyser, just love like coursing through the body, flowing out. And there are times when metta can be like that. It can be a kind of rapturous type experience where the whole body feels just flooded with a kind of gripped by the experience of love. But it's that shouldn't be the way we assess the practice. And I know one monk's, the way that somebody described his metta was that it said like his metta felt like light from distant stars. So it's not, it has different ways of expressing itself, and we want to be careful about using some standards to assess ourselves. Now, we usually think of metta practice, and how many people have done metta type practice? Yeah. We usually think of it as a kind of cultivation practice. That is, we're cultivating, or maybe in some frameworks of the mind, remembering or accessing loving friendliness. But metta functions in, we could say, at least three ways. And the first way we could say is cultivation. We're cultivating loving friendliness. We're actually developing this capacity And that's of real value. That's the predominant frame of mind when we think about, like, okay, I'm going to generate or access love, a kind of sense of loving friendliness. And that's great if that's how practice is unfolding. But it's not secondary if practice functions as either concentration or purification. So what do I mean by that? Metta practice can be, sometimes it may be very dry, like there's no, the kind of juicy, soft kind of feeling of metta is totally absent. And it's like, it can feel just very, not desolate, but just dry. Dry, quiet. And in those times, we may be using the phrases of metta, saying things like the simple wish, may I or may all beings be happy. And there's absolutely no feeling that's being generated at all. Metta practice can still function beautifully just as a way of training the mind, as a way of gathering the attention, of focusing wholeheartedly on the phrase that we're being offered. And then there's the purification side, namely that we can be here and have this intention towards loving kindness, and what actually arises is the opposite. You know, it may be sadness, maybe anger, resentment, guilt. And this is a very common experience of metta, is that it, like, it actually opens the gates to feel what needs to be felt, and it softens the kind of resistance, so that just seeding the mind with thoughts of kindness allows things to arise that don't arise otherwise. I remember in practicing metta, when I, you know, in the first 5 years of practice, really, it was a very reliable experience during long periods that I would do some metta, and often just for a short period, a portion of the meditation period, and sort of tears of mysterious origin would arise. And I didn't even know what they were, and I wasn't actively, consciously grieving anything specific. But it was a kind of process of just almost like wordlessly making peace with my life, with what it's like to be human. And over time, the tears got kind of more and more soft. That was the feeling. They it would be rare that I would actually feel some kind of sadness doing the mindfulness practice. But there was something important happening that I didn't understand. I still don't actually fully understand. I don't exactly know what I was crying about. But they felt like essential tears. And becoming more and more like something like compassion, or just being moved by the poignancy of being human. Like it's when we actually look at what it's like to be human, it's incredibly poignant. So the encouragement really is not to get in the mode of practicing metta, like having some fixed idea that it's supposed to be about cultivation. Very productive practice can be done as concentration or as purification, where we're actually digesting that which is not metta. So the way that I sometimes think about it is like we're ringing a bell, right? We ring the bell with the phrase of metta, which is said in a kind of mantra-like way. We ring that bell, right? And we ring the bell in the mind with the phrase. And then we listen to the reverberation in the body. May I be happy. Maybe it's love. Maybe it's silence. Maybe it's hate. We're not intent on hearing any particular sound. We're just ringing the bell and listening. There's an art exhibit, maybe I've mentioned it here, and I don't know, let me just, as a prefatory comment, I don't know much at all about art. So I may be missing important allusions to other artists, and you know, I'm simple in how I approach it. It's like, what happens to me when I look at that? So I didn't go. I didn't even know about it when it was happening. But several years ago, Marina Abramović did a kind of performance. I see one face lighting up. Yeah. Performance artist piece at, I think at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And the whole thing was sort of set up to like, and it was called The Artist is Present. And the way it was structured was, you know, it's like everything put you into an awareness of the present moment. And one of the kind of central feature of it was that the artist, Marina, was like sitting on stage in a chair, not behind a table, just there. And a few feet away was another chair. And the exhibit, in part, was that anyone could wait in line and come and sit in that chair and could stay as long as they wanted. And Marina was just there looking at them. And some people stayed less than a minute. And I know at least one person stayed over 6 hours. There's a long, you know, line of people just waiting, which of course is another way of bringing one into practice. And I saw this this series of photographs, and the photographs were taken sort of the museum goers, you know, the people who were looking back at Marina, and it was, they were very like beautiful photographs and very well done. And in this series of photos, all of the people were crying. And it was so touching. I'm just thinking back on their faces. The faces broadcast, like they were all crying, but each face said something very distinctive. And each face had, it felt like it was saying something that needed to be said. And it was that experience of emotion, the intensity of that was enabled by a kind of the gaze, the presence of another. And I think about that a lot when I think about metta practice. That in a certain way we're gazing upon our life. We're ringing that bell with the phrases and then seeing what arises. Central in this for me is the practice of metta is the face. Just actually really looking at people. No doubt as Abramovich was looking at people. The face says a lot. The face of others say a lot. Says Stephen Batchelor. Even when no words are spoken, your face calls out to me. The first word of the face, says the philosopher Emmanuel Levinas, is the thou shalt not kill. We recognize this call because we hear in it the echo of our own deepest fears and longings. Another's face shocks us into a helpless silence in which we're called to respond from the same depth within ourselves that we witness in his plea. The roots of empathy, compassion, and love lie in that intimate encounter where we hear the other wordlessly say, "Do not kill me, do not rob me. Do not abuse me or deceive me. Do not betray me or insult me. Do not waste my time or try to possess me. Do not bear me ill will. Do not misconstrue me." More and more as we practice, it's like that plea becomes louder, clearer. Like we see that more clearly in the eyes of others. Like, do not harm me. But then the question, of course, is like, what do we see when we look at our own face? And sometimes in retreat, we're not asking people to do it now, but sometimes I'll ask people to place a hand on their face. Actually, just to feel the kind of innocence of the body. Like this part of nature, just like the innocence of the body. And much of what we're doing in metta practice is learning to actually see ourselves in those ways, to sense something that I'm calling innocence. Some people might call it goodness. The innocence of the being. And from that appreciation of our own innocence, goodness, much of benefit unfolds. The Buddha said that one who loves themselves will not harm another. You can see as our own longing for happiness, as our own goodness becomes more poignant. Of course, that generalizes to others, right? As the drama and poignancy of our own suffering and our own happiness becomes clearer and clearer, as we touch that with more and more clarity, the implications are so clear. It's like, okay, this is what it's like to be human. Let's just sit for a moment. So whatever goodness you sense here tonight from our efforts together, may that remind you of your own goodness. And from that, how could anything other than goodness emerge? So thank you. Thanks for having me. Felt a little retreat-like in here. Thanks, anyway.